chilling greetings, and I mean just that. It's cold out there. Hoping everybody is staying warm. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from tiny mountain town to the hustle and bustle of the biggest of cities that refuse to sleep, from desolate desert to remote village to a tropical paradise island and everything in between. It is greatly appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts go to Winona, Minnesota, Haringey, England, Winnipeg, Canada, Berwick, Pennsylvania, Cottonwood, Arizona, and Iron River, Michigan. My grandpa, Gerald, he was an amazing man. He was such a loving and caring son, and he religiously kept in touch with his parents, siblings, and friends back home during World War II. Sometimes it took a little longer than he would have liked, but by golly, he was quite the impressive pen pal. Now, I'm going to read a couple of short letters and one decently long one, and you're going to tell quite the difference between these shorter letters and this long letter, which gives us a front row seat to what these men went through during the Second World War. With this long letter, I have several family members that will be reading bits and parts of it, so I'm super stoked about that. The woman is standing in the kitchen, making some of her special sugar cookies, larger in size than your average sugar cookie, and that's just the way her family liked it. Once the sweet, buttery taste of the sugar cookie hit the taste buds, it was pure heaven and bliss. She looks over lovingly at her husband, who's sitting in his favorite chair in the living room, newspaper in hand. A lot's being said right here, right now. It is 1943, and a war is taking place. The woman looks at her husband's face to see if she can tell if there's any sort of bad news or anything, but he shows no response. Her heart skips a beat. Her son is fighting in this very war. She wakes up with him in her thoughts, and she goes to bed with him in her prayers. She makes a mental note to be sure to go to church this evening and pray for him, maybe light a candle. God, oh God, please keep her beloved Pride and Joy healthy, happy, and safe. She continues to bake in the kitchen. Smells of delicious scents emanating the air. Making another note that when her son comes back home, she will surely be making and baking all of his favorite things. That includes, yes, the sugar cookies. The mail arrives, and she smiles when she sees a letter from Corporal Gerald Morrow. Carefully, she opens the envelope, walks into the living room to join her husband. With one hand, she puts on her husband's hand. The other, she waves in the air, revealing the letter. He smiles, carefully folds the paper, places it on his lap, anxious to hear what his son has to share. North Africa, February 6th, 1943. Dearest Mom and Pop, do you remember a year ago today? February 6th, 1942? Yep, that's the day I came in this army. Time has really flown. It seems like just yesterday that I packed up and left for Fort Logan. Yet, vaguely, it seems as though I have been in the army all my life. Living as I am now, I haven't regretted the last year. I have seen and done a lot that before I had never imagined. If you can bear with me when I get home, I'll probably bore you stiff telling you about everything. And getting around to when I will get home, I am confident that by the way things are going now, it will be a very short time, much sooner than I had first expected. I received the boxes that you and Marianne sent the other day, for which I am very grateful. It was really good getting them. I am wondering if you ever received the purse I sent you. I hope so. I also received the package of papers, including the post. Thanks a lot for that, too. I am curious to know whether you have received any of my bonds at home yet. I think by now I should have four or five accumulated. I suppose that now it is quite cold there at home. The weather here has been swell, almost perfect, except rather cool at night and early morning. I am in bed every night by 8 o'clock, and we get up at 7:15. I'm certainly making up for what sleep I lost while there. I don't know if I have gained any weight as I haven't been on a scale, but I think I have. I should. I eat like a horse, and of course get plenty of sleep. I really can't remember of ever having felt any better than I do now, and I hope that you too and all the rest are likewise. I'll be in church praying for all of you tomorrow, and until later, God bless you and please take care of yourselves. Lovingly, Gerald. My great-grandmother and great-grandfather were so proud of their son, as they were of all of their children, and I can only imagine the joy they felt, and I'm sure, whew, a sigh of relief, when they would receive one of my grandpa's letters, one of his many, many letters. And it was definitely scary times. So many mothers and fathers saying goodbye and praying for the best to their children. Wives giving their husbands one final kiss, children wrapping their arms around their father's neck, not wanting to let go, the father not knowing if they would ever be in each other's presence again. So I'm absolutely sure that these letters was an absolute godsend. As my grandpa would say, in the army, no news is good news. So right now, I am holding a letter of my grandfather's. And it was a V-mail, short for Victory Mail. V-mail was an easy way for our veterans to reach home to their families. March 26th, 1943. Dearest Mom and Dad, I'm awfully sorry that I haven't written the last few days, but as I mentioned in my last letter, I think that I probably wouldn't write for a while due to congestion of mail, etc. I have also been very much occupied the last few days and probably will be for a while, so there won't be too many letters from me. But because you don't hear from me for some time, please, as I said before, don't be worried or alarmed, because I assure you everything with me is okay. I also haven't received any of your mail, which I am sure you have written for quite a while. I hope you'll excuse the pencil. My pen at the moment is dry, and this is all that's available. They have finally permitted us to reveal some of the places where we have been since we hit Africa. I assure you, I've seen some country, namely Casablanca, Rabat, Algiers, Oran, Constantine, and others. I'm sure you can probably find all these places on the globe in the parlor. I've been a little away from home, don't you think? I can't, however, reveal where I am right now, but I assure you it's rather interesting. Love and regards to all. Gerald. The woman, she's in bed. She's nestled up next to her husband. She's in a deep sleep and is having a dream about her son. He may be in Africa right now, but right here, right now in dreamland, he's right here in front of her. She goes to the kitchen and gathers a spoon and bowl, gets ice cream, and she hands it to her son. Oh, God, he loves the stuff. He cannot stay away from it. Mime is what he would call it. Gotta love his mime. You see, the family owns the local creamery here in town in Walsenburg, so it's no shocker her boy, along with the whole family, loves his ice cream. She watches as he eats it, smiles, goes in to give him a big hug, but she wakes up before she can. April 13th, 1943. Dearest Mom and Dad, gosh, the months are sure rolling on. Here it is, April already. Apparently, in my estimation, too many more months won't roll by, which I'll be home. I am just wondering what the newspapers and magazines at home are writing about all of this going on here in Africa. I certainly don't think it is a secret to anyone, including Germany, that the African campaign will soon be but history. The Allies have done a wonderful job here, and we certainly have to hand it to the English, especially the Eighth Army. They have a great army and a great general, General Montgomery. I don't think I mentioned it, but several weeks ago I had a tremendous toothache, and out in the middle of a desolate nothing, I had it yanked, quite primitively. I also incurred quite a cut in my little finger recently, which is almost well. Outside of that, everything has been wonderful with me. Remind me to tell you about the finger. It's quite interesting. Outside of that one tooth that I lost, all of my hair is fastly disappearing. I have an ugly red mustache, too. You can imagine what a homely-looking sight I must be. Deepest love to all, Gerald. The man sits there in the parlor. He looks at a photo of his son. He stares at it, picks it up, and wonders where he is right now. What's he doing? Is he okay? They just got a letter a few days ago. He smiles and thinks, my boy, I'm so proud of him. Where is he right now? What's he doing? Is he okay? May 8th, 1943. My dearest Mom and Dad, it seems as though I haven't written you for quite some time. I hope you'll forgive me, though I've been awful busy. It appears as though now I'll have a lot more time to write. I am wondering just what you people at home are thinking about all this fighting that's going on here. I guess it's no secret that the British, the French, and us have done a marvelous job, and I suppose that just about now some pretty historic and long-awaited four headlines are flasking across the newspapers at home. It's really something. I just wish that I could include in this letter a lot of things that I am sure would be censored. Believe me, I'll have a lot to talk about when I get home. I just saw a recent edition of Life, and it showed that picture of Casablanca the night they bombed it. I assure you, I was really sweating out those planes that night. And that picture? It wasn't exaggerated. I never imagined such a beautiful display as was in that sky that night. It is at times like that a guy is really grateful and thanks God that our cities and towns at home are thousands of miles away from such horrors. My deepest love to you, Gerald. So as you see in these past letters, not much can be disclosed when it comes to the situation of the war. In fact, there were times that my grandfather would write something in a letter that maybe should not have been written, and you could see that they, the censors, must have had these box cutter-like tools or other type of razor-like instrument to perfectly etch out what needed to be taken out. Like, it couldn't have been taken out more perfectly, just this perfect little tiny square box or, you know, however much needed to be out. So this next letter that you are about to hear, and believe me, you are going to want to hear this, and this is where my beloved family helps me read it. It's going to give us a front row seat of some of the events that exactly took place during part of World War II, taking us back to 1943, and some of the things he's talking about may be from 1942 as well. And reading parts of this just blew my mind. You can watch documentaries, right? You can read history books. What really amazes me is to hear from the mouth or the penmanship, right, of somebody who actually experienced it firsthand. There's no other feeling like it. Buckle up, you guys. This is about to get truly intense. And again, I'm excited to have my phenomenal family helping me read this epic letter. May 16th, 1943. Dearest Mom and Dad, now that Tunis, Bizerte, Cape Bon, and the last strongholds of the enemy have been taken, bringing to a close the North African campaign, we have been permitted to disclose in our letters many things that, before, would have been censored. I will try to give you a little idea of what has transpired since I arrived here in Africa last November. It will probably be rather lengthy, and I might not get it all in this letter. As you already know, Casablanca was our first stop here, and a rather long one it was too, almost 3 months. At Casablanca, we hardly knew there was a war going on, except that one night when 5 or 6 German bombers flew over and dropped a few eggs amid a dazzling display of anti-aircraft fire. After a fashion, Casablanca was more or less like being near one of our cities at home. And as much as there, we could go to town on passes, all our work was practice or dummy training, and all that we know about the war is what we read or heard over the radio. We almost thought that we were going to spend the duration in Casablanca, but one day we packed up everything and moved up. I thought sure we were going up to the front, but as it turned out, our destination was near the city of Rabat, a coastal town about 60 miles from Casablanca that I would judge is about the size of Pueblo. I won't go into too much detail about Rabat, except that it is a very beautiful city, much cleaner than Casablanca, and the women there, ooh la la, that incidentally is the town where I met the girl whom I mentioned in one of my previous letters. I don't suppose I'll ever see her again, but I hope I do. Our routine there at Rabat was much the same as it was in Casablanca, at both places, and ever since I came into the 62nd, my work has been in battalion headquarters in the office of the battalion S3 as a draftsman and clerk. But comparatively, we were there just a very short time, 3 weeks. Then, one day, the commanding officer at a mass gathering at the battalion informed us that we were going to the front and for us to prepare to go into what definitely would not be a picnic.
We had ahead of us a trip that was to cover some 1,500 miles, and it was to be made by rail. I have often sat around in bull sessions at the Elks Club or elsewhere and heard some of those rugged veterans of the last war boastfully remark, "You guys certainly will be lucky in this war. When we were operating, they shoved us around in cattle cars." Well, that is exactly what we were shoved into. My home for 7 days and 7 nights was in the dirty little cattle car with cow dung and manure filling the many cracks in the floor.
The car was originally about 75 years ago built, I think to handle about 10 cows or about 18 GI soldiers, but as it was, our car had only 8 men, which I was mighty fortunate for us, because some had 12 or 14 men. The railroads here in Africa are very difficult to describe. The tracks are just slightly larger than our narrow gauge tracks, and though they must be very durable, you would think that from all of the noises that they made, they would give out any minute. The cars were definitely ancient, and if you think the old D and RGW was rough, you should see those cars bump and bounce along. Our car naturally leaked when it rained. Quite a nice feeling to wake up at night. We slept rolled up in our bedding on the floor with the water dripping right smack on my face. And it seemed also to sort of freshen up the stuff that was in the cracks. As this railroad was the main and very important supply line up to the front, we were warned to be constantly on the alert for attacks from the enemy aircraft. Fortunately, no attacks were encountered on the trip. We slowly edged our way up, going through Port Lyatli, one of the initial landing points in the invasion of North Africa, Meknes, Fes, where the Sultan of Morocco holds forth in a huge castle, Taza, and about 12 o'clock one night we came into Oujda, the last large city in Morocco before crossing the international boundary line in Algeria. Those of us who were sleeping were awakened and told that coffee and donuts were being served. In a rickety little building near the station, six Red Cross women from home, three of them quite young and beautiful, one from Colorado, were putting out donuts and coffee. All you could down. Believe me, it was invigorating. And not only the coffee, but just to look at those gals from home, the only ones I had seen over here outside of a few nurses. When I got through coffeeing up and got my share of mutely staring at the women, I left and encountered an old Arab who had six or seven knives that he was selling. I bought one, and I hope to take it home with me as it is rather quaint. The trip, in spite of everything, was very interesting. Some of the country through which we passed was indescribably beautiful. I would like to describe the scenery, but it would take pages and pages. After coming through Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, I think that a guy can truthfully say that he has seen just about every possible type of terrain and hundreds of different varieties of flowers and shrubbery.
I think the most abundant flower that I saw was the big red poppy. You could see fields where there were thousands of them growing, and in many cases, other flowers of different colors were growing in with the poppies, really making a beautiful contrast.
We passed through many mountains, some of them rather high, but nothing to compare with those we have in Colorado. We went through many very long tunnels, and I sometimes shuddered when I thought what might happen if the enemy, while we were in one of those tunnels, should blow up the openings. But all the openings were very capably guarded by native Arabs in the French army. We later, in the offense on Bizerte and Tunis, learned to really respect the ability of these fearless natives who played a magnificent part in the Ally victory. Up from Oujda, Tlamin, St. Belebs, Mascara, Relizan, Orleansville, Algiers, Seti, Constantine, and down to the city of Kraub, where we unloaded. All along the way, we saw trainloads of wrecked equipment and vehicles and planes, and at times we saw cars full of injured men. We were definitely approaching the front. From Kraub, we headed for Tebessa in our armored vehicles. You will probably recall that Tebessa is where the Allies stopped the February advance of the Germans when they recaptured from us the towns of Spletla and Feriana and Gafsa. Tebessa is a very old town, and nearby there are still ruins of old Roman buildings built hundreds of years ago. Tebessa itself hadn't been hurt much, but there was evidence that there had been a war going on around there. We camped near Tebessa for several days. Then we were ordered to move up. We stopped in a very dry desert-like place that seemed to be miles from nowhere. We had always been taught how important it was to have foxholes or trenches, so every time we moved, the first and most important job we had was to get our holes dug, and fast, for now we were subject to not only bombs from airplanes, but we were getting close enough to where we could be reached by artillery.
The second night that we stopped at this last place, I was besieged by the second toothache I've ever had. God, I was really in misery. The next morning, I unwillingly forced myself to go and see the dentist, who had left most of his equipment quite a ways back. He informed me that I had a very bad tooth and that it would have to come out immediately. He stretched me over the front seat of a Jeep, got his pinchers out, And right out of the middle of a desert in nowhere, he yanked it out. I ask you, isn't that a hell of a place to get a toothache?
Later on in the day, several of us around our vehicle had all of our clothes off, and we were taking a bath out of our helmet. I had my face full of lather, and I was just beginning to shave when I noticed about 16 planes hedgehopping very low over the ground and coming for us at a terrific speed. Oh, you should have seen the confusion. We grabbed our steel helmets, water and all, made a very beautiful swan dive into our foxholes. Now they are coming right over us. Any minute I expected to hear all hell will break loose. But I looked up and saw that they were our planes, P-40s. I imagine we looked plenty funny crawling out of holes with nothing much on except our steel helmets. From this place, we went to a place a little way beyond Gafsa. We pulled in there about 5 o'clock in the evening, and that evening, we, for the first time, turned loose some of our artillery in a pass that was occupied by the enemy. We didn't do a lot of firing that night and hadn't heard anything from the enemy, except about midnight, several planes flew over and dropped flares and bombs on an area that was adjoining ours. At the same time, they must have gotten some pictures of us, so realizing that, we were ordered to move early the next day. And thank God we did that, because the next night, the place where we had been was heavily bombed. But we were the little men who weren't there. I suppose the Huns really thought they had us blasted. Just about all of our traveling was done at night now, so that our moves would not be subject to different types of attack. Believe me, it was rough, too. Traveling most of the night over rough fields and desert land, where there had never been a road. And then, after we would stop, we would have to dig our foxholes.
One night, or should I say one morning, about 4:30, we pulled into an olive orchard just about a mile from McNassy. One of our officers informed us that we were very near the enemy and that we should be very cautious. We could hear a lot of shooting from a U.S. artillery unit stationed near us, but still, we heard nothing from the enemy. After a few hours of sleep, we arose and started what was to be a very eventful day.
About noon, our gun batteries began firing on observed enemy targets. The S3 section in battle is called the Fire Direction Center. In other words, it directs the fire of all the batteries. It is also, at that time, the command post of the battalion. Consequently, we were usually in the center of the battalion. After firing a while, our observers informed us that we had made some direct hits on some enemy tanks, but still nothing from the enemy. I was beginning to think that there wasn't any enemy anywhere near us, and remarked to one of my friends that this war was rosy. Then all of a sudden, we heard a shell whistling, and we saw it hit about 600 yards away from where we were. That kind of made us sit up and take notice, but it was quite a distance from us, so it really wasn't too bad. But then a second one came. This time, the whistling was a lot louder, and the shell hit a lot closer, then a third one, then a fourth, each time getting louder and closer. By this time, we were all in our foxholes, and they were really pouring them in on us.
You have probably heard about the much talked about German 88mm gun. That is what they were shooting at us. I have had a lot of scares, believe me. I was never so genuinely scared as I was that day. You could hear the report of the guns going off, then the sickening scream of the shells, then the thud and the deafening explosions of the shells going off when they landed, and they were really hitting close.
Then They had a bead on us, and they knew it. This orchard was in a valley surrounded by large hills, and the Germans were in these hills shooting down on us in the valley. Though it sounds hypocritical, I never prayed more fervently than I did in that foxhole while those shells were dropping around us. And the good Lord certainly must have been watching us, because it seems miraculous that none of us were killed. Some of those shells had burst not over 6 feet from some of the foxholes. We did have, however, several men who got hurt that afternoon, and a truck driven by my friend Charlie Bly was hit, but not seriously damaged. That pounding lasted several hours, but it seemed like years. After that day, we were definitely considered veterans. They had really broken us in super style. We later read that that particular enemy artillery was one of the heaviest barrages encountered by us in the entire campaign. About 6 that night, we got ready to pull out, and when it got dark, we moved. We moved just about a mile from where we were that afternoon, and again into an olive orchard. Things were really hot there, too. We began firing immediately, and about 9 in the morning, their shells started whistling toward us again and hitting treacherously close. That morning, I had a little accident cutting one of my fingers clear to the bone. We were in this position for quite a while, and a day didn't go by that we didn't get fired upon. I'll never forget in the field adjoining the orchard, a big brown camel was holding forth. His Simon Legree Arab master had probably been frightened away, and Mr. Camel was really on a vacation. He stayed in that field and just grazed all day long. And when they were really pouring them in on us, I don't suppose a human could be seen around there, because naturally everyone would be in his foxhole. But it didn't worry Mr. Camel one bit. He would just keep on eating, and when a shell would explode nearby, he would just sort of look up. And I suppose he was thinking, what a bunch of maniacs we humans must be. I can't understand how he didn't get hit. I don't think he was very happy when the war was over, because he did have it soft. The last day we were there, I got the box that Josephine sent. It was really welcome. Oh, the candy was delicious. It had been a long time since we had had candy. I almost forgot to mention that very often German planes flew over, but we were very well protected by an anti-aircraft unit attached to us, and who really did a swell job of keeping the planes high up in the air.
One day, 18 bombers were seen coming toward us. We thought the jig was up for us, because, believe me, 18 bombers can do an awful lot of damage. They went straight over us without dropping a single bomb, and went over a field about 700 yards from us, where a terrific tank battle was taking place, and dropped a lot of bombs where our tanks were supposed to be.
Though we had definite air superiority here, then our planes at that particular place was very rare. And just about the only planes that flew over were German. One day, 2 planes came swooping over, and I jumped behind a 50 cal machine gun and opened up on them. I got about 8 rounds out when the gun jammed, and I was really thankful that it did and that I had not made a lucky hit on the planes. We later found out that they were English Spitfires. Several days later, we moved again, this time about a mile and a half from where we were. We did get shelled there too, but compared to what it had been, it was fairly mild. We really did a lot of shooting though, and now the Germans were pulling back, and we were hearing nothing but good reports. They were beginning to talk about an early victory. I bet a captain in our section 100 francs that it would not be over by the 15th of May. Of course I lost, for it was the 13th, but I think officially it was over by the 14th. We stayed at this place about a week, Then we pulled out and went back through the Kasserine Pass, up through Spletla, and way up to the coast near a little town sitting right on the coast of the Mediterranean. This town was La Cale, a beautiful little city, typically European. It had a large, very nice-looking cemetery right in the middle of town. We went a few miles beyond town and set up a camp, which was to be more or less a rest camp. We didn't do a thing there but lay around, and we just took it easy. Enemy planes flew over almost every night and dropped bombs nearby, but never close enough to us to make any difference. After a very nice rest period there, we get ready once more, and one night started on a trip toward the front, which would eventually take us within several miles from Bizerte. We went back down through La Cale, and the trip was very uneventful, except that we went through some of the most beautiful country that I have ever seen here.
Fields and fields of flowers. I don't know why, but I am really getting to like flowers. On the trip, we were constantly alert for enemy planes, but didn't see any. I did see a lot of ours, though, and it is certainly a secure feeling to see those swell planes bars flying around over you.
We ran through a small town called Beja. This town had been in the midst of a lot of fighting, both on the ground and the air. It looked like a beautiful little city nestling on a hillside when we came into view of it. But the sight of it when we passed through, it was tragic. It was almost completely demolished. I don't think there was a building in it that hadn't been shelled. However, a church right in the center of town seemed to have been damaged very little comparatively. The country into which we were now approaching was very hilly. You would go up one and then down another, and it was like that all the way up to the coastal plains just a few miles out of Tunis and Bizerte. That night we stopped on the side of a hill, and again we were ready for action. Now we had to be extremely cautious and constantly be on the lookout for German booby traps and personnel mines, of which the enemy had left plenty in their retreat. I don't think I was ever so surprised in all my life as I was that day as we were moving up. Of course, all along the road on both sides was different units, either ours or English or French. We went down one of the little hills, and right in the middle of a small group was a band. A large band was playing. That beat the heck out of me right up on the front.
The next day, we began shooting on observed targets again, and our shooting was very effective. As the enemy retreated, we moved up. In just a few days, we had moved up 3 or 4 times, and we were getting very close to Bizerte. In those last few days, we expended great amounts of ammunition, and I can well understand why the enemy retreated so fast, because I don't think anybody or anything could stand very long under the terrific poundings that we and many other units were dishing out.
One day about noon, our firing ceased, and this campaign, as far as we were concerned, it was over. Believe me, it was a swell feeling to realize that. We were all very proud of our organization and the marvelous troops of infantry who were always fighting ahead of us.
Those in the French army, both French and the Arabs, they did a splendid job, and I think everyone realizes how valuable General Montgomery and the Great British 8th Army was. After laying around 3 or 4 days, we moved to a spot just about 2 miles from Matur. Matur was another unfortunate victim of this war. Like Beja, it was almost completely demolished. Our organization conducted sightseeing tours through Bizerte, Tunis, and Carthage for a certain amount of men daily. It was really interesting to see those towns that we had heard so much of. Bizerte was damaged quite badly, but Tunis was in fine shape. Tunis is a city of approximately 285,000 people, and it is really a swell city. Carthage, of course, was interesting just to be there in a city that hundreds of years ago was the most important and powerful city in the world and the scene of many famous battles. Many of the ruins of those battles are still standing. The Colosseum, where lions were turned loose on Christians who were being persecuted and martyred, is still there. Overlooking the site of an old ancient cathedral stands a new and modern, and I suppose one of the most beautiful cathedrals in the world. Well, I guess I could go on and write pages and pages, but already the censor will probably want to shoot me, so I had better bring this to a close. I left out a lot of small details that I would like to have included, but couldn't. I just wanted to give you some sort of an idea of what I have been doing. Please pardon the hundreds of mistakes which I know are in this letter. If any of the rest of the family are interested, I wish you would show them this letter, because I certainly don't think I could have time to write 3 or 4 of these. In closing, I want to mention that so far, I have had a wonderful experience that I wouldn't trade for the world. I feel 100% perfect. And I am anxiously looking forward to the day soon when I will be home again with you. I love you both, and God bless you. Gerald. I hope you guys and gals enjoyed this letter, all of these letters, as much as I did. And a huge, huge shout out to my lovely voiceover people, aka my family. Several who would not be here today, including myself, if my grandpa never made it out of the Second World War. His beautiful children, my father, Gerald, my aunts, Mary Jo and Andrea, my uncle, Red, and my grandpa's granddaughters, Casey and myself. Then we have his lovely niece, Randy, and his sweet daughter-in-law, Rhonda. I love each of you with all my heart, and I'm so proud to call you family, and I'm super, super stoked that together we were able to bring this intense part of Grandpa Gerald's life alive once more. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others, they are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to worry, just hit up any of those fantastic podcast platforms such as Deezer, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, Player FM, Blueberry, Castbox. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and I will see you next week.